It's time to travel to the next room with Jane Asher, an exploration of the bigger picture surrounding life on Earth and what follows. Now, here's your host, Jane Asher, on Empower Radio.
Welcome to the next room. I told you last week that I was going to invite Nadir on the show, and he agreed to come on the show, and it's to say that my heart is pounding through my chest is an understatement. This is such an important time on the planet, and to have somebody willing to speak to me and tell me from his perspective what he's feeling. And he just is, you know, he just released a brand new song that deals with what's happening right now. It's called Run. I'm going to play it for you. But first, a little about Nadir. He's an artist, musician, producer, multi-award-winning songwriter, activist. The last time I had Nadir on the show, it was to discuss legacy and everything that he discovered after his mother had transitioned. And he was left to go through her home. And it was really, really a very personal show, full of memories. This show, I have to say, is probably as personal or even more. I've asked him to come on the show and discuss why he wrote Run, what Run is all about, and what is happening from his perspective. It was just released on Juneteenth. I want to play it for you now, and then I'll welcome Nadir Omowale to the show, and we'll have a very in-depth discussion. This song is it's about the daily struggle for every Black person on the planet. And he actually wrote this song in 1998, and it was after the lynching of James Byrd Jr. He's rewritten it, he's re-recorded it over a dozen times, but he finally released it in 2020. And it's available now. It's inspired by just this horrible stream of senseless murders of Black women, men, children, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Robert Fuller, and so, so many more. So here's Run on the next room. And when we come back on, I will introduce Nadir and we'll have a very in-depth discussion.
Not 1 degree, 'cause if they catch me, they will throw me back in chains. We'll be right back.
back to the condo. I tell the Moomba, it's not too late, no, no. I tell my brothers in Zimbabwe, I'll be there. I think I can run this race forever. If I can only catch my air, if I can only catch my breath.
Can't stop,
I've got to keep on moving.
How far can I run?
How far can I run?
How far can I run?
Welcome to the show, Nadir. Oh my gosh, that song is unbelievable. You sent it to me. I got to hear it yesterday. I got the whole package, and I listened to it over and over, and with tears streaming down my face, because it's just so, so very important. Talk to me about the song and why now? I know why now, but tell me, in your words, why you released this song right now.
Thanks for having us on, Jane. Yeah, like you said, I've been working on this song since 1998, and we are really at a critical time, and I think even when I decided that this was the time to finish Run, was before the murder of George Floyd. So I think this is something that we've been coming to for a long time, and the song really goes back and speaks to troubles that we've dealt with over and over again. And I think that is really the point of the lyric, is that these incidents keep recurring and these injustices keep recurring. And I keep seeing all of these things about the protests surrounding the death of George Floyd and all of that. And no, that might be the reason that a lot of people are protesting, but for Black people of African descent, we've been going through this for centuries, and this is just another time when all of these things are coming to a head, and there's this anger that builds up, and so now, because there is technology and because people can see it for themselves and see, you know, we've been telling people for years that these things happen.
Right.
And people can now see it for themselves. And so I think that's why there's such a groundswell at this moment. We'll see if we can sustain it. I hope that we can sustain the energy through the summer, and, you know, everybody's been cooped up on quarantine, and so when they get back out to their jet skis and their swimming pools and all of that, we'll see how much energy they have to protest. Hopefully we'll be able to sustain this because it's going to have, you know, that again, it's about perseverance. This is a marathon, not a sprint.
Right. I was just discussing this with a very dear friend of mine yesterday, and, you know, we're both very emotional about it, and we're both wondering, you know, what is it that we can do? You know, what can we do to finally bring the attention on this tragic situation and stop this from happening? It just has to stop. It just can't go on.
And, right.
And
a friend of mine, Lauren Hood, made a post last week, I believe, that said, a lot of people are asking, what can I do? How can I help, you know, at this moment? And I think that the best better question is, how can I be? You know, how can I be the change that I want to see? And, you know, I think you're already there in so many ways, and you work really hard to help people understand, you know, what's going on and how we relate to just the things in our daily lives. But I think we have to get to a broader context of how do we want to be as a society? Are we willing to continue to accept the fact that so many people don't have the basic needs, that don't have basic fundamental equality, that people are not treated the same at the bank or in school or at the hospital, or, you know, when they encounter a policeman on the street? And I think that we have to think individually about how am I going to be as a person? And then from there, I believe we can have a broader conversation about what is it that we want to be as a society? How do we want to behave as a society? How do we want to relate to our fellow human beings? And that's when we will hopefully start to see a little more progress.
Wow, that's beautifully said. Instead of what can I do, how can I be? You know,
right.
How can we be as a society? Because it is so painful. And I mean, I can't even imagine from your perspective. You have two young children. And, you know, I'm sure that you and your wife must have, I mean, how do you deal with that, Nadir? How do you educate your two beautiful children about what's happening?
The twins are 7 now, and it's so early. We're doing our best to shield them and avoid the conversation at this point. It's tough. I mean, what do you do? How do you explain it in a way that a 7-year-old is going to understand these things? And so they came behind me as I was watching a video a couple of weeks ago. And they just came down into my studio. I wasn't really expecting them to see me watching this. But when I saw them, I didn't turn it off. I let it go. And my son Miles asked, you know, Daddy, why do the police shoot first and ask questions later?
Oh, man. He's 7.
He's 7.
Wow.
And, I try to explain, well, it doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes they do. You know, it's tough. How do you have this conversation with a 7-year-old who is, you know, still, you know, the things that he is grasping and dealing with are on the level of, you know, Star Wars and fantasy and
sure.
Those are, you know, understanding the difference between fantasy and reality is a really, you know, it's a different kind of thing right now as a 7-year-old,
right?
Just shaping his worldview, and the same with my daughter Maya. They're in first grade at a school in Royal Oak, Michigan, and we sent them there because it's a really good school. The academics are just fantastic, and we've grown to love the principal and the teachers, and they're doing a really fantastic job. But culturally, there are not as many brown kids at the school, which is their terminology. And the twins have come to me and said, you know, there are more beige kids at our school than there are brown kids. And the, you know, beige, because
sure,
that's a more accurate.
Right. Sure. Thank you.
It makes more sense.
Sure, it does.
So,
so
for them, I asked, I said, is this a problem or is this just an observation? They're like, it's just an observation. You know, it's not something that is a problem as yet. I think Maya noticed because she was the only brown girl in her class this year. And that gave her, she just
sure
felt something.
Well, yeah.
And I don't know, and it's, you know, I'm not there with them in the classroom, so I don't know what they're experiencing and why they feel that they're singled out. She does have there are other brown boys in the class, but she's the only brown girl. Whereas Miles's class is a bit more diverse, but there's still, you know, more beige kids in the class than brown kids. And so they're kind of at that point where they're noticing things.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't gotten to the point, at least, where they can tell where it's made a difference yet. Although Miles has come back and said that, you know, he's had kids on the playground go and tell the teacher that he was doing things that he wasn't doing and things like that. Maya has had some questions, even back to preschool. Maya has had some questions about her hair and the texture of her hair versus the texture of the hair of the girls in her class, where she sometimes wishes her hair was straight versus it being coily. We've been dealing with this one for a little while, and we're having a little, you know, it hasn't necessarily gotten any easier. She has gotten to where she appreciates her hair a little bit more, but the girls in the class want to touch her hair, and
right?
Well, that, so does that make it, you know,
it's weird.
There's just so many things that, like,
right,
you know, that other kids don't necessarily have to think about.
Sure. Yeah.
And at this point, like I say, it, you know, they're just learning, and they're just forming a view of the world around these differences that they see. And so luckily we haven't had an incident yet.
Good.
Where I have to have, you know, the talk with them.
Right.
But I can imagine that it won't be too long before somebody says something or something happens where we have to really, you know, dig in and have that discussion and they have to understand, you know, the reality. So.
Right. You know, it pains me because we're all the same, you know, we're just here for a minute or two and we're trying to bring about, you know, peace and love and understanding. And I just, we have to be better. You know, we have got to be better. So your writing run, you write it in 1998, and it was because of the lynching of James Byrd Jr.
Yeah.
So what happened between 98 and now 2020? You keep rewriting it. There had to be like this level of, I've got to get this out. You know, this has to be now. And now is the perfect time for it.
Yes. And I, you know, when I wrote it originally in 1998 and with the incident that happened with James Byrd in Jasper, Texas was just horrendous. And, you know, it was different at the time because there were still a lot of stories about, you know, police brutality and there were, you know, there was still a great deal of discrimination and things happening. You know, we're at the end of the crack epidemic. People are being incarcerated left and right. There's a lot of the discussion then is about crime. We're, you know, mm-hmm. years after the LA riots and things like that. And the James Byrd incident was so obviously an old-fashioned lynching,
mm-hmm.
where he was taken and you know, accepted a ride from some guys, a guy that he knew, and that guy and the two other guys in this pickup truck chained him behind the truck.
Ugh.
And dragged him for 3 miles.
Oh, geez. After
beating him.
Yeah.
And abusing him for who knows how long. And so that really just, it hit me in a way that was really difficult. And I had, you know, I've been writing about injustice and was writing a lot about it. I have a song, you know, on an album that I did with a band, my band in 1995, that was really written about the LA riots and there, that is, you know, that type of discrimination and oppression and social issues are not strange in my writing. I write about what I see.
Right.
And this particular incident really hit me, and I imagined what it would be like to be behind a pickup truck and for it to start moving. I got the story wrong. In fact, I didn't find out until a few years ago. I thought that they had chained him by his wrists, and that he's standing behind the truck, and then they put on the gas, and he's got to run. And so my original thought was, you know, how far can I run? How long can I keep this up? How long can I stay on my feet before I fall? And because when I fall, it's over.
Right.
You know, and that was really the thinking when I wrote the song. What I found out later is that they had actually chained him by his ankles. He didn't even have a chance to run.
Yeah.
He didn't have an opportunity to get on his feet. And they of course had beaten him badly already. But, you know, so they dragged him for that 3 miles. And, you know, I recounted in my blog post, there's just really horrible, horrible what happened. What I imagined was less horrible than the reality, but still this idea that you have to stay on your feet for as long as you can.
Right.
The race is not going to come to the swift or the strong. It's going to be to those who persevere until the end. And that was really the idea of the song for me. How far can I run? So I wrote the song on acoustic guitar in my living room and performed it at a really awesome open mic night that we used to have in Nashville called The Spot. And as I was reflecting on the song afterward, I felt like it could be more universal, that it had to speak to more than just that one incident. And the original version of the song really was very specific about, you know, imagining the summer sun raining down and the heat and being behind this truck and thinking, how far can I run? And I changed the lyric over and over and over and over again over the years to get it to where I felt like it was better, more universal, still specific enough. I changed the music. I had a computer crash. I lost the music.
Oh,
I re-recorded the music. I re-recorded a different way, doing different things. And so it's been recorded a bunch of different times. I've sung it a dozen times or more, you know, changing the lyrics, changing a line here or there. And then even as we were working on the music video a couple of weeks ago, I said, I'm going to make one last change to this lyric to tighten it up just exactly that much more. So literally 22 years.
Wow.
I've been writing this song over and over and over again to get it right to where it says what it needs to say. And I think it's there. I think it's finally there.
It is. It is. And, you know, the time is now.
So I guess there's no.
Yeah.
No,
well, perhaps, you know, we weren't ready to hear it. You know, I mean, it's shocking to me that you and I have to sit here in 2020 and even have this discussion.
Right. It's the 21st century.
Right.
No, that's crazy.
It is. And we have to get through this. And before we actually went on and started the interview, you said something incredibly poignant, and it was about a birthing process. Will you repeat that for the audience? Because it was beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people have noticed and do feel that there is a shift going on. And, you know, we are, based on the Mayan calendar, we have entered a new age. And we are starting another period of moving through the galaxy and through the universe. And emotionally and spiritually, I believe that we are coming to a place where things are about to change. And, you know, a lot of us do feel that energy. And what we're dealing with right now is a birthing process. We're going through a birth canal. And birth is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
It can be painful. There can be complications, and this is where we are. We are moving from a consciousness, an older consciousness, and a selfish, greedy consciousness, a self-centered consciousness, into a place where we understand, hopefully, that we're all in this together, that we are all the same when it comes down to it, that you know, that there is no reason for things to be different for you and for me based on the color of our skin. That just is ridiculous.
No kidding.
It's like it might, you know, there's again, Haile Selassie's speech that Bob Marley immortalized in his song War. It's like the color of your skin is no more significant than the color of eyes.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
From a scientific standpoint.
Right.
We have cultural differences. We are different people. We don't want to be colorblind. This is a world where, you know, I believe that God created all of the infinite variations that we see throughout evolution for a purpose. And all of those infinite variations are beautiful in and of themselves just because they're different. And so for us to treat each other differently because you grew up on a different part of town than I did, or, you know, it just makes no sense.
No.
It makes no sense to me.
Nope.
And so I feel that there are more people who believe this and that I hope there is a paradigm shift happening. I believe it. I see it. But there's a lot of resistance, and there are a lot of people who are invested heavily in maintaining those old paradigms and keeping the old ways. And it is really up to those of us who understand what the world could be, that we have to be a different way.
Right.
And we have to act in a different way, and we have to treat each other differently, or we're going to be stuck again, you know, dealing with these same things over and over and over and over again. And my good friend Jabbar Harper did the artwork for this project.
It's really good. I mean, it's frightening.
And I knew him from Nashville, and we had never worked together on a project, but I just had a sense that he would be able to speak to the moment.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that we came up with and that we talked about back and forth was this idea, when you look at the artwork, that you see this man who's running from the police.
Right.
But he's running through a cotton field.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Right?
Yep.
So, you know, yes, he's running north. He's not running into the cotton field. He's running out of the cotton field, but he's in that same place, right?
Right.
He's in that same place with the same things going on that our ancestors were in, you know, 200 years ago. We're dealing with a lot of these same issues, and we've got to get to a place where we break out of the cycle, and that we can make the changes that are important to finally live up to the things that Thomas Jefferson wrote but weren't living himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's he really captured it. It's really beautiful, but it's incredibly painful to look at.
Yes.
But that's important, you know.
Right.
We have to get to the point where we're uncomfortable and we're discussing difficult situations so that we can get through this birth canal and be better. We're better than that. You know, I tend to surround myself with, you know, really peaceful, loving individuals. It's just important to me. Life's too short to hang out with assholes. And I really live by that. But I'm really aware that, you know, there's this, like you said, there's an old paradigm. There's this, you know, holding us back, and they're so tied into that. And I truly feel, Nadir, that it is pure fear. It is fear-based baloney is what that is tied to. But I also feel, too, in having, you know, two young 20-something children and listening to their conversations and knowing about their best friends and their relationships. Boy, if it's any indication, I just feel like my children's generation is really going to carry us forth, because they're so tied into this and they care so deeply. And the conversations are absolutely amazing that are going on, not just in my home, but with my children online, with their friends. It gives me hope. I have to have hope. Otherwise, I would just cry every day, which I've been doing anyway. You know, it's just been it's difficult. It's difficult to see the news, but you can't stick your head in the sand.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope that, I think that with this generation, they don't have a lot of the illusions that our generation had, right? Our parents, you know, our parents had a different situation, and there was still this idea that things were going to get better as for your children than they are for you, you know, from a financial standpoint, from a security standpoint, all of those things. And our parents worked really hard to make it so that it could be that way. And for those kids, your children's age and my children's age, even, you know, even beyond, they're seeing that a lot of these old social contracts were bankrupt. They're seeing that people aren't being paid more.
Right.
They're seeing that they're seeing these injustices because social media and technology allows you to be, you know, on the other side of the world immediately, and to see how people are living in not only down the street but somewhere else, if they understand and they can sense that, and hopefully, you know, as parents we've taught them to be more aware of what's happening outside. And so I think that that's why this generation is rising up and refusing to live by these old contracts. And I hope that they can continue that energy. Like I say, when it's summertime and it's nice outside and they haven't been stuck in the house for 3 months, you know, that I think is, I think a lot of this energy that we're seeing right now has to do with the pandemic.
Yes.
It has to do with both with the disparities in healthcare that we see, in the way that some people's lives have been completely turned upside down and other people's lives have gone on just as they normally were.
Right.
And then also that we've been in this place where everybody's has been stuck inside, and I know I've talked to a lot of friends that this has been a time, and it's been for me a time of deep reflection.
Yes.
And a lot of that, you know, what am I going to do? What am I going to be when I grow up? Kind of reflection, you know, how is this going to be different when I'm back out in the world again? And so a lot of the energy that we see currently with the protests, I think, has to do with that immediate circumstance of being in and needing to get out and having that frustration and wanting to get out and be angry.
Right.
And so what I hope is that, you know, that as things open back up and hopefully we don't see a second wave and hopefully we are able to enjoy some semblance of a normal summer, I hope that that resolve that
doesn't
that
dissipate,
doesn't waver,
right, doesn't dissipate as the virus reset, you know,
right,
goes away. But
back to school,
right,
or
yeah,
you know, or Labor Day and
right.
You know, everybody's going to, you know, once there are festivals and there are things like that, the people take their minds off of what's happening right in front of them.
Right.
And get to that point where life is sunshine and roses for some people, and for other people, it's not.
No, it's the same old stuff, just different day. But isn't it interesting that during this pandemic, and yes, I do believe that, you know, people have been cooped up and everything, but I feel like it was so necessary, like the timing of all of this, like almost the coronavirus and then what we're having with our absolute horrible race issues right now, they're so tied together. And it's almost like the virus was, it shed the light, you know, it, as horrible as it is. And in all the horrible deaths that we've had, I just feel like it's like this time on this planet, it's like, oh my God. You know, one just leaned right into the other, and the spotlight is there now. I really don't think it's going to go away. I really don't. I think we can't go backwards now. We just can't.
Right. Right. And you know, that's a phrase that we use in the song and in the video as well. Forward ever, backward never, was a quote from Kwame Nkrumah when Ghana became an independent country, and he was the first prime minister of Ghana. And that is, I think that's, it's really important. We have to keep moving forward.
Yes.
We can't go back to the way things were. And I hope that it doesn't. I think that a lot of people, you know, a lot of people profit from keeping us separated. A lot of people profit from poor people.
Yeah.
Being taking care of poor or being poor is very expensive. It's a very expensive proposition, and it makes a lot of people a lot of money because they just milk those who are impoverished, and so, you know, there are a lot of people who benefit from all of this division and from all of the strife and struggle and discrimination. discrimination on a day-to-day basis. I mean, and these are some of the things that we have to deal with. I mean, the fact that you know, an African-American can have the same credit rating and the same income and pay higher interest rates on a mortgage just makes no sense.
No, it's bullcrap.
But people, you know, obviously people are making money based
right.
on that.
Right.
And, you know, people are making money by there are these for-profit prisons that have contracts with municipalities and with states that say you have to keep a certain number of people in jail so that we can maintain our profits and we can maintain our lifestyle. You know, we're not focused on making those people, we're not focused on rehabilitating those people. We're not focused on giving those people a better life when they get out of prison. We're focused on how can we keep them in as long as possible? How can we make sure that they don't gain any skills and don't gain any resources so that they are right back here 6 months from now? So that we can continue to make money off of them.
Right. Boy, it's just...
I mean, this is where we live.
It's big business.
It is. It is. And people profit from that misery.
Mm-hmm.
That's where...
Wow.
I think the difference is going to come is that those of us who understand and... you know, are aware of what's going on, we have to continue to make noise and make sure that we don't go back to those places where, you know, the essential workers are the ones who make the least amount of money. You know, those essential workers should be paid like they're essential.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know?
Yep. Yeah.
And instead, these are the people that have to go to work.
Right.
Because they can't afford not to go to work. Not because they're not, you know, they don't have to go to work because they're essential. That's part of it. But the other part is they don't have a choice for a lot of them.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it shouldn't have to be like that. And I think you're right. I think that the pandemic and the quarantine, we got to open up the bandage, I guess, and see some of the deep wounds that we have as a country and as a planet. I mean, it's like this everywhere else. And I think it's more pronounced here. I think we saw the inequities here because we're far more unequal than a lot of other countries are. But it is a worldwide problem.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, it's just the pain has been incredibly deep, and I'm so hopeful. I'm hopeful that we can, you know, move on and learn and become not tolerant, because I think tolerance is ridiculous. We have to become equal. We have to understand that we're all created equal. Just simply because someone is brown or beige, what does that have to do with anything? You know, what if we were all blind? I mean,
right.
Seriously, what if we were a blind society? I mean, what would we go by then? Smell? You smell different than I smell. How stupid is that?
Right. Yeah.
Just ridiculous. So,
it sounds different over there. I don't want to go over there because it sounds.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And,
ooh.
And yeah, you're right. I mean, those are really valid points, and I think that it is important that we understand. You know, the friend of mine that I collaborated with on this track, Simone White, is a drummer that I met when I was on tour with. I was touring with an artist named Mephi B, and he was touring with Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, which was Michael Franti's group.
Oh, wow.
Michael Franti, Charlie Hunter, Simone, and they had a Chinese brother in the group named Ron Osei. And, you know, they were just this really fantastic group. And Simone moved to Australia when he met a woman and fell in love when they were on tour, but wasn't able to stay, had to finish his obligations and you know, went on with his life and got married, got divorced. And years later, he meets this woman again and decides, you know what, I'm going to give up everything and I'm going to move from San Francisco to Sydney, Australia. And he's there in Australia, and he's a bit isolated because he is one of few brown people that are there.
Right.
And he's teaching children in the schools. He's doing a lot of production and playing. But he, you know, we talk about the racism and things like that that he has to deal with. And Simone is just one of those people that just, you know, the fact that he would uproot his life for love just explains exactly who he is. You know, he is guided by love.
Mm.
You know, that's his North Star, is this feeling of you know, wanting to give to people and wanting to help people. And you know, the technology has allowed us to work together now more than we have, you know, over the years. And that's fantastic. But it also, you know, it also helps to highlight that these differences and these problems and these issues are happening everywhere.
Right.
It's not just happening here. And that, I think, is something that, you know, as people are protesting all over the world, they're protesting, a lot of them are protesting the things that are happening here, but they're also protesting the racism that they're dealing with in their countries. I think there were protests in Germany, and they're protesting the rise of racism and xenophobia in Germany.
Right.
Which is a really big problem. And that, I think, is another thing, is people are starting to look in the mirror, and this is helping other nations to think about what's going on with them. And yeah, we can, you know, I think one of the things that I saw that again was brought about by the pandemic is that other countries have looked at the United States in the past and have been envious or they've hated us for whatever reason, and the pandemic, I think, made them feel pity for us because they could see the inequality and they could see the way that our government was mishandling this crisis. But now I think that it also, that light that was shined on America, they're now turning on themselves. And so hopefully they as well will continue those struggles and continue to work to bring about more equity in their own countries.
Right. Break down that struggle.
Right.
I felt very encouraged when I saw what was going on the planet, you know, and not just here in the United States. So it was like, okay, here we go. We are definitely working our way through a very painful birth canal right now.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll come out a very healthy baby. And, you know, just continue to, like, what did you say? How did you put it? Forward ever, backward never. I love that. I love that. I love that. I love that. I'm going to put that in bold print. So,
yeah. And, you know, like I say, I am hopeful and I am encouraged, but I'm, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic because this has happened so many times.
Right.
You know, the civil rights movement, I think we saw civil rights legislation come about because people were finally had television sets and they could see how brutal people were to their fellow citizens. And, you know, and things changed, but then they kind of just evolved and other things, you know, other inequities replaced those things. So I think that we have to you know, we have to keep moving forward, but we have to remain vigilant, and we have to make sure that we are keeping our faces forward so that we don't go backward, so that we don't, you know, our the whole, not to get too specifically political, but the whole notion of making America great again, you know, is this idea that we need to go backwards. And you know, it's not, you know, it wasn't great for a lot of people. It never was great for a lot of people. And so, you know, for those of us who never had it good, you know, we don't want to go backward. We want to move forward. We want it to keep getting better. And I think that that is really the point, is, you know, and that's why Run really is about this idea of, we got to keep going, and we got to keep going until we can't run anymore. You can't stop.
We're at a junction. We're at a major junction, and you're right. You know, we don't need to go backward. It, you know, that's why we are here in 2020 having this discussion about what's been happening on the planet and the race issues. It's just, I'm like stymied when I see what happens, what just recently happened in Atlanta. I'm like, what? What is, wait, what? You know, this individual is running away. You know, yes, there was a struggle, but, you know, how about a little, you know, a little shot to the leg or something? I mean, Yeah.
Well, you know, the death of Rayshard Brooks is really crazy. And that's just a horrible thing. And Trevor Noah spoke to that really well.
I love him.
Yeah, he's so good. I was really worried, you know, when he took over for Jon Stewart.
I was too. I was too.
Pick a black South Africa guy, but his insight is just so on point.
Oh, he rose up, man. He rose up, and yeah. he big fan. So finish your point about him.
But he, you know, he brought up the thing. It's like, okay, yes, there was a struggle. But what we have to remember is this guy was drunk.
Right.
Okay. The reason that the police were coming was because he fell asleep in the Wendy's drive-thru.
Right.
Because he's drunk. And so, you know, that's, first off, we're calling the police instead of just waking this guy up and telling him to move his car.
Right.
First off, that's the first problem. For the police to deal with this guy who is drunk, he's, you know, maybe he was driving drunk or whatever, you know, but he's not driving right now. Can we just take him home? I live in Ferndale, Michigan, and we recently, last year, our police chief resigned for a couple of different reasons, one of which was that he himself had caught the mother of another police officer, and she was driving under the influence. And he called and said, come and pick up your mother. She's drunk. I'm not going to take her to jail. She needs to go home. It's your mom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that is, to me, yes, he is applying the law differently than what the law says. But that is also a very compassionate and rational thing to do when somebody is drunk.
Right.
Okay. Would he have done that for the next person that he caught? I don't know. But I can say that was, I don't have a problem with him doing that in that instance. It was a very human thing to do.
Right.
Okay. So that kind of is the thing. They could have taken this guy home. They could leave his car. He's in a parking lot. Leave his car in the parking lot. Take him home. Tow his car. Drive his car home. Take him home. right? There's no reason to arrest him. And that was the thing, is he did not want to be arrested. You know, when you're a black man and you're arrested, the entire trajectory of your life changes.
Sure.
It changes everything. You know, do you get to keep your job? Do you get to keep your car and your insurance and those things that you need to get to work?
And your children.
Your children. Mm-hmm. Do you get to keep your children? All of these things, so many things can be messed up when you're arrested. And so I don't know why he struggled. He was drunk, and that was another thing that Trevor Noah brought out. He's drunk. You don't expect drunk people to act rationally.
Right, right.
Police officer is going to see this, and he's acting irrationally. He's drunk. And so he struggled. He took the taser from the cop, and he ran. And he's drunk. You've got his car. You're going to be able to find him later.
Yeah.
We don't have to shoot him, right? I have a cousin who is a commander of police in a large city in California. And we talk about these incidents all the time. And he really helps me because he gives me some insight into their training. And he says that in a situation like that, they are told not to shoot somebody in the leg. If you shoot them in the leg, you maim them, they're still going to sue you. They're still going to sue the department. It might be worse if they have a weapon that may not take them out. You know, he says that under some circumstances. Now, I haven't asked him specifically about this case where they're shooting somebody in the back that's running away.
Right.
We haven't had this conversation, so I'll specify that. And he would specify, you know, this. He looks at it from what happened with this incident and what happened with that incident. He's very careful about saying, you know, this should happen this way and it shouldn't have happened that way. He's very easy to explain why police officers did the right thing and didn't do the right thing in a particular situation. So we haven't had this conversation, but he has told me that they are taught not to just injure.
Okay.
One.
Okay.
That creates other problems, and it may not solve the problem that you had in the first place.
Right.
But what does seem to happen with a lot of people is that police officers have no problem diffusing a situation. In a lot of instances, the shooter in Aurora, Colorado, that shot up the movie theater, didn't they take him alive?
Mm-hmm.
Dylan Roof goes and shoots up a church, and when they find him, they arrest him without incident, and they take him to Burger King. You know,
mm-hmm.
are able to diffuse the situation in certain circumstances. In other circumstances, they don't bother to try.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crux of it. We talk about, you know, these police officers need training. Oh, they need better training. They're not taught to defuse. No, they do know how to defuse a situation. They just don't apply everything equally.
Right.
So, what are we? How are we supposed to do? What do we do?
Yeah, you know what? You run.
That's what's
I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah,
just unbelievably sad. But you know what? I go back to what you just said a little while ago about that you do have hope, and that, you know, we have to. We really need to move this forward and keep up the momentum. And we can't look back. We just have to keep moving forward. And I think now is our time. And with this song, Nadir, we're getting close to closing, and I want to play another version of the song at the end of this interview. You released the song on just on Friday, on Juneteenth. And what, let's just talk about, you did some donations for it, which I thought was really, really smart.
Well, I released the song through a website called Bandcamp.com. And Bandcamp is a really great site for musicians because it does give us a little bit of control and ability to reach our audiences a little differently than it happens with some of the other larger sites like Spotify and iTunes and that kind of thing. So Bandcamp really is very musician friendly. Throughout the pandemic, on some Fridays, they have been donating their commission from record sales back to artists.
Awesome.
And so on Juneteenth, they decided that they would instead donate their commission to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And so I thought that was a great opportunity. Releasing Run on Juneteenth was going to be about when the timing happened anyway for everything to come together. So it really made sense.
Right.
Juneteenth, of course, is Independence Day, because slaves in Galveston, Texas, were not told that they were free. It was 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. It was, months after the Confederacy surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. And so they celebrate June 19th is Juneteenth, and those celebrations have been growing throughout the country over the past, over the past several years at least. And so it made sense for us to release this on Juneteenth. And so that was, I think, for Bandcamp to offer their proceeds, was really helpful, and hopefully, I don't know the numbers yet, but hopefully we have seen, hopefully we've been able to contribute at least a little bit to that important fund.
Yeah, awesome. It was released on Friday, Juneteenth. It is available now. So where would I go to purchase my own copy of Run?
You can still go to my website, which is nadiromowale.com. You can go to nadiromowale.bandcamp.com to purchase. It will start showing up on iTunes and Spotify and all of those channels within the next few days.
Okay, great.
And so it will be available everywhere. The video was just released last week, and it is really impactful as well. And again, Jabbar Harper worked on the lyric video, and because we were quarantined, we had to we couldn't do a regular video, so we did a lyric video, which I think is helpful with this song because you really understand what it's about. And just he took some of the imagery from the artwork and added additional imagery that just is really powerful and incendiary and just really makes you feel the impact of the song. So I really am very happy working with him. And so the video is available on video outlets, YouTube, Facebook. Just got a TikTok account that I've set up. So
good. And we'll put everything up on the show page too, so you'll be able to, go directly to a link. You can also read about what the song is all about, which is, this is Run. And it's a strong, he wrote this song in 1998, and here it is in 2020, and could not be more poignant and important to hear this song than right now in this moment. So, excuse me, on that note, Nadir, I cannot thank you enough for taking a full hour out of your day. I know the twins, I know you've been doing a lot of homeschooling. I'm hoping you can have a fun summer, but yet keep up the heat, forward ever, backward never. Nadir Omawali, I am so pleased that you would come on the show today.
Thank you so much, Jane. Always great to talk to you.
Here's Run on The Next Room.
If I can only catch my breath,
can't stop.
I've got to keep on moving.
How far can I run?
How far can I run?